When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Shepherd's Life. It's one thing sort of saying I'm going to write a book.
Yeah.
Did you know, and obviously clearly you'd been at Oxford, and did you know how to go about it? Because I would imagine you have to be very focused.
So the other jobs I'd done off the farm, between leaving Oxford and publishing that, 7 years ago?
Yeah.
So there's like a decade where I do other jobs, and a lot of that's writing.
Okay.
But writing reports, I knew I could write sort of good plain English. I knew that people would comment on my reports are good and clear, and like, wow, somebody's spoken some plain sense about this.
Yeah.
So I knew I could do common sense and clear writing. And then I was writing these poems, which are much more sort of literary behind the scenes, thinking just keep practicing, it'll happen.
Yeah.
And I nearly cracked it just at the end of when I was leaving Oxford. I wrote some pieces for a magazine called Country Illustrated in London. And I just about made the point I was writing some quite nice feature pieces, 2 or 3 pages long. They were quite nice stuff. They went in among other stuff like that. Didn't look out of place. Mm-hmm. So I knew I could do it. There wasn't any fear. But yeah, writing a book's a different thing. And then my life, we started to have children. We've got four kids. And we're trying to get back to the farm. And that was taking all my free time up, like doing a job and being a farmer. And then 10 o'clock at night, you're going to sit down and write a masterpiece. That was a bigger ask than I was capable of living up to. And it's worth saying, actually, how difficult it is for so many people to write. Like, can you imagine being like a single mum? Single mum in a flat looking after 3 kids and trying to juggle a job on low income. Is that person going to write a masterpiece? Mm. With very great difficulty. So the truth is most writers are juggling. I'm not sure how I got into this place. What was the question? Did I know how to write the book?
Did you know about the process of it? Did you know that?
No, I just right up to when my book was auctioned as an idea and a bunch of top publishing companies bid for it, and then I was signed up. Even at the moment of signing up, all I really knew was that I had an idea of what the book would be, what it was, and I knew I could write some pretty nice stuff, hopefully beautiful stuff that people might react to. Did I actually know physically how you structure and plan and do all the things that a grown-up writer would do? No, I still don't. I'm still fumbling about making it up as I go along. And do you know what most writers are?
But perhaps that's why it feels so real, I guess.
Yeah. I think so. So what I tend to do, my basically writing process is there's a moment of my childhood or my youth or whatever. I know it's a scene. I don't know what the scene's for. I don't know why it matters, but it's important to me, like a moment where something meant something, and I'll just play around with it, and it might be like a 1-page, 2-page long poem, or it's just written out in sort of plain prose, and I just end up with a mountain of those when I'm writing a book, and then I look at it and Helen looks at it and we all go, oh my god, what a shambles. it's not all the same tone, it's doing different things, but somewhere in that, after a while of soul searching and absolute fear and panic, you think, actually, I know what this is about. Give the example of my latest book, English Pastoral. English Pastoral is about how farming changed over the last 40 years and how it changed through the lives of my grandfather and dad and me. And I realised that what a lot of my scenes were about that change.
Yeah.
Like the modernising and the making things supposedly better. And then the moments where you realise, actually, we've been criticised for this, and somebody else says it's bad for the environment. And so all those, that's what a lot of the scenes were. And then, you try to pull it together. You show it to an editor, and they say, "Yeah, it's shambles." And have you thought about doing it this way? And I work really collaboratively with my editor, Chloe Curran. She's really smart and has the distance from it to say, "We thought about trying this," and I'll try different things. She says, and somewhere down the road of a lot of, and there's a lot of being scared, and utterly confused, and thinking, "I'll never get it done." Somewhere down the line, you realise exactly what the book is. This is how I work anyway. And probably more grown-up writers are listening to this going, what a bloody shit. Somewhere down the line, it starts to make sense. And you think, actually, there's a few joining bits and it's got sort of flow. And The hardest bit is some of the best things you've written are going. Some of the best stuff I wrote an opening. I wrote an opening to this book, which I still think might be the best thing I've ever written.
Yeah.
And it didn't go in the end, and it didn't go in for a structural reason. It just more or less told you too much too soon. It wasn't the right thing. I'm like, wow, I think I devoted 3 months of headspace to those 6 or 7 pages over the years.
Yeah.
We're not even going to use it. Wow. So there's some pretty hard stuff happens as well. And then the most fun part at the end of that process for me is in the week or two before you're published, you spent enough time seeing it as a whole. You're like, oh, I get it now. I really can see it. Like, that bit's not quite as good. Quick tweak that, or this bit's too long, lose a paragraph.
Yeah.
And then you're getting quite tight. It's the final minute when some of the best stuff happens.
Yeah, I suppose it is. I mean, where does it, with that first book, was it a very emotional experience?
I found both of my proper, I did like a picture book thing, which is a smaller thing, but both of my proper books have been memoir. They've been about everything I care about and everyone I care about exactly who I am or who I think I am.
Yeah.
That's quite exhausting.
Yeah, but it's
quite exhausting to dwell on. Like, and it requires an exhausting amount of introspection. Mm. Like, am I a nice person?
Yeah.
Have I been a good person? You get to wondering about all that stuff, you know. Was I a really crappy son? was my dad a good dad? You know, this is quite tiring, emotional stuff to be grappling with. And, so it takes a lot out of you. And I think if I've got it, if I do it, and if it works, and books are entirely subjective, aren't they? It's up to the people that read it. But if it does something in their heads and they think, wow, this is good, I think it's because you had to go to those quite tricky places and you had to really get down to the nub of the truth of these things. And then certainly in the new book I've written, English Pastoral, it's quite blunt about what happened to farming.
Mm.
And that's quite tricky stuff to write about because I'm inevitably saying stuff that might be about your farm. It's about my dad. It's about the people I live alongside who might not have the same views as me. Mm-hmm. That's quite tiring as well. Quite stressful in your head. You think I don't want to alienate everybody I like. And yet there's tough stuff that needs to be spoken about.
Yeah. Well, you have, I'm a huge Bruce Springsteen fan. Some might say an obsessive. And in his autobiography, the common thread throughout really is a relationship with his dad.
Yeah.
And that was a lot. I would say that's the same with your book, really. And it would be if I had the talent to write a book, it would be the same with me. And as I'm sure it would be for many other sort of farmers who worked with their dads, that complicated relationship. You said that it became a book about how much you loved him.
Yeah.
Did he realize that in the end?
So the really good news, if anybody's thinking of writing a book that's 20 years old and angry, hold off. so when I was 20, the book that I was going to write was quite a damning book of my dad.
Yeah.
It was going to be an angry young man book. Like, who's this fool getting in my way that doesn't know anything? And it actually, we'd got through that. 20 years later, he's different. I'm different. You've grown up. You respect each other. You found the sort of common ground. But we were mates, really, for the last 10 years of my dad's life, maybe 15. Quite good mates. Occasionally frustrated as hell with each other. I think we're both crackers. But, when I was writing the book, it had changed. It had very much changed. It was a much more respectful book about my dad. And it was a book about being wrong about your dad in some ways. Like, sort of growing up and going, do you know what? I think my dad's maybe all right. He's maybe one of the good guys. And then he was, by the time I was maybe a few months away from finishing the book, my dad had cancer and was probably going to die. Did die 5 years ago. He died just a matter of weeks before the book was published. So he read it as a proof. I told this story before, but it's worth saying again. I took the proof round to show him, and I thought, I'm only going to get one crack at this. Like, much as I love him, he could be dead soon, and it's all about him. It's all about his faults in some cases, and I'm thinking, shit, that's not a good time to offend your dad, is it? As he's on the way out the door. And I don't want to either, because I love him. And so he read it, and I saw him, and he said something like, oh, he's done all right. Dad, no, please give me more than that. I'm not going to get any more than that.
Yeah.
Oh, actually, his words were, I said at the end of the book that I dedicated it to him because I loved and respected him. And he said, I liked it, he said, but the last line's a bit soppy. So it was too soppy for Northern farming dad.
Yeah.
But I said to my mum what happened. She said, he's not going to tell you, but he cried all the way through it.
Yeah, okay.
So I'm going to cry, Tony. And then I said to my sister Jane, I'm getting emotional telling you this. Can you find out what he thinks?
Yeah.
And he knew exactly what I'd done. He said to Jane, he said, I'm a bit surprised by this book. I come out of it as a fucking legend. And he knew.
Yeah,
He knew we'd been to some darker places and we'd come out the other side, and he knew I was telling him that I loved him. How many times have you cried on this thing? Well, I'm crying. You're nearly crying. And actually, by the time the book came out, I was really lucky. Everything good that can happen to a book happens, and I had a huge bestseller and all that. It doesn't really matter. I didn't need that by the time it came out.
Yeah.
What it actually became, and I'll be grateful to my dying day about this, is it really became a letter to my dad.
Yeah.
And my dad read it before he died. And sorry, I'm going to cry. But I said to him like a few days before he died, I said, are you and me all right? And he said, yeah, we're spot on.
Yeah.
God, I'm doing a David Beckham. I'm crying. I haven't discussed this for 2 or 3 years. Like, people asked me about that previously, but and like, what a gift.
Yeah.
Like screw it being a bestseller. Yeah, screw anybody else, what anyone else thinks. My dad got it.
Yeah.
And I know when he died, I remember having a really clear thought in my head, which is, there's nothing else that I would have said to my dad.
Mm.
I said it. And what a wonderful thing, isn't it? To have got your saying out the way, to said sorry, to say I was a bit wrong. And I do love you. I do respect you.
Mm. Yeah. Incredible. Sorry.
Don't
apologise. I've made a lot of changes on the farm in recent times. Anyone who follows you on Twitter will have seen pictures of what you've done. I've been lucky enough to see it in person today. Why did you start to focus on a more, and I'm not quite sure whether this is the correct term, but a more nature-friendly way of farming?
I think it's as good a term as any, isn't it? There's a lot of
there is a lot of terms around. I never know which is.
Nature-friendly farming, that'll do me.
Yeah.
So why did we change? We had a strong tradition in the family from my granddad. Certainly I can remember my granddad loved birds. Mm-hmm. He was proud of this place because he thought it was good for nature. It was like full of, and it, as the 1980s and 1990s went on and farms intensified outside of the valley and even our other rented farm, it was very clear, you couldn't miss it actually, that there were more birds and more insects and more butterflies, and the hay smelled sweeter here than it did elsewhere. Even like the hardened lads on big machines that would come and bale the hay, even now, get off the machines and they go, oh, this smells like proper hay time.
Mm.
This is like it used to be. And there's a sort of nostalgia there.
This is powerful.
And you think, what's going on there? I remember sort of trying to process it, thinking, why is it got no birds there? And why is the bird here? And again, this is what my new book's about. And that led basically to probably through to the Twitter days when I'm quite in the firing line for everybody who wants a poppet sheep or upland farming. And I'm proud of who we are, proud of what we come from, really proud of my community, love my sheep. And yet there's some pretty heady, powerful criticisms getting whacked on the table against us. And I think you can either be a jerk about that or you can digest it, can't you?
Yeah.
And I probably did a little bit of being a jerk. And then after a while, I was like, all right, I need to know about this. Like, talk to me about this. What is it you're really telling me is missing off my farm? What was it? And I think I discovered there was a lot of things that, a lot of questions we'd never thought to ask.
Mm.
It just wasn't our business. We did what we did and it kept on going. There's a lot of things were happening to nature, I would argue more elsewhere, but even on our old-fashioned farm, there was a sort of stripping away of hedgerows and a loss of the little fields and getting to bigger fields, and there's sort of more set stocking rather than rotational grazing. The hay meadows had a bit more fert on, so they had a bit less diversity in them. I started getting to terms with that, and people who I might once have argued with, I started inviting them to the farm.
Yeah.
And I've now got, I don't know, 6, 10 dozen amazing, so I call them nature nerds, which some of them like, some of them don't, who have become friends, really.
Yeah.
So some of them critical friends, some of them just out-and-out friends. And I use them as a sounding board, and I'm like, all right, walk around the farm with me. How could it be better for birds? All right, tell me about the river. Oh, damn, it's a straightened beck, straightened by people. That's not good for fish. It's not good for gravel. It's not good for... we haven't got any standing water. Where can we put a pond? And that's coincided with me taking over the farm fully from my dad 5 years ago. Probably had sort of run it 50-50 with him for the previous 10 years, maybe. And it's become a passion of mine, really. Mm-hmm. I've started to really enjoy it. The feedback loop on it is amazing and quick. everything we've done, there's been like a buzz within about a month afterwards. Like we fenced some riparian strips off, riverbank strips. A barn owl came to nest on the farm within about a month because there was more voles. We've changed ponds and we've got little egrets and way more herons than we did have. There's way more sort of waterfowl, geese, ducks, all the rest of it. There's green sandpipers have been on in the last couple of weeks. I know it's a cliche, but they say that thing like build it and they'll come. And I'm starting to see just how far below perfect maybe our farm was. And I think, if I'm honest, I'm stubborn. And part of my motivation for that is if we're going to carry on doing what we do, we're going to be here and we're going to defend it, we better have some good answers. Because the public are putting some money into these landscapes, sometimes considerable amounts of money. They have every right to ask whether that's a better investment, in my opinion, than a nurse or a doctor or a school teacher. Mm-hmm. And I think we better have some flipping good answers for them and then have some flipping good stuff to show them.
Yeah.
And if I can find a way to do that around my culture, around my traditions, around my farming, I'm going to bend over backwards to do that. And the interesting thing is I'm not alone. There's a quiet revolution happening in these valleys where a lot of people here, definitely a third, maybe half the farmers I know, are really mixing things up. They're not giving up on their farming systems necessarily, but they're doing some really heavy tweaking around the edges or some really serious innovations. And just some little tweaks like lengthening the break in rotational grazing from a couple of weeks to 4, 5, 6 weeks, sometimes 14 weeks we're doing now. That can have an amazing effect on biodiversity. And the quite cool thing is rather than having fights and being criticised by ecologists, we now have ecologists crawling over the farm saying, this is pretty good. This is starting to look like a one kind of solution. And we're a hill farm in a national park at 1,100 foot up. My answers aren't going to be your answers. I'm your farmer. I get that. I think there's going to be a lot of different solutions to what they call it, nature recovery all around the UK. But I just want to... if I want to keep growing the things I care about in this landscape and keep doing my herd with sheep, which is really my core passion, and I want some public support to do it, then I want to be right up there putting my hand up saying, look what we can do. Look at the ponds. Look at the amazing amounts of insects and birds on my pastures that I've had 14 weeks to recover. Look at my riparian strips. Look at my pigs in my woodland that are churning things up. And my nerdiness, which didn't used to be applied to farming other than sheep breeding, I think I was a little bit indifferent about land management for a lot of my life, is suddenly my nerdiness has switched onto this. I want to know everything about soil. How do you build soil? How do you get organic matter into it? How do you manage grazing to be most productive? I know there's a lot of good farmers that have been into this for a long time. I'm not the innovator. I'm really into that and I want to know. And then the nerd in me that used to be a nerd about history books or whatever to impress a professor's become a nerd about soil science, about biodiversity. I think the key thing on these farms is not just managing the grazing better, but rebuilding the patchwork around it, the patchwork of different habitats, the patchwork of different management, the grazing at different levels in different fields, enabling different plants to happen in different places. And I'm really into it. Like if I can farm well and deliver what the public want for their money, I'm not embarrassed by that at all. I'll both take the money and then try and impress them with what I spent it on.
Yeah. As we move out of the direct payment system in the UK and into the public money for public goods and whatever that ends up being, for a lot of farmers, they are quite they're not quite sure how they're going to make that pay for them. How do we farmers, you mentioned your farming system is very different to mine. How do we, as a group of farmers, get through to policymakers and get across? So, look, this is what we can do on our farms. Yeah. We need you to back us, but this is the system we need.
I think we've got to show them solutions, haven't we? We've got to show them solutions and show them that we're willing to own this, not just be defensive, but to actually listen, actually come up with constructive proposals of our own. And like just in the valleys around here, there's a million trees been planted in the last 5 years going to the Woodland Trust. That's a lot of that is sheep farmers showing flexibility, showing adaptability and saying, all right, we need more trees. We hear you loud and clear. Here's the best place to put them. Let's put them there. How do we get their attention? I think we need to, I'm a storyteller, so I think we need to tell better stories than the people who don't believe in us.
Yeah.
And we need to I've probably done my bit. Other people can have a go from now on. Maybe, but we need to tell that story. So, yeah. if I'm really honest, and I know this maybe isn't as constructive as it should be, but I've never been a person that was a member of anything.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a member of the NFU, even though I think we may have the best leader of the NFU mm-hmm. we've had for some time,
possibly ever.
Possibly ever. I'd agree mm-hmm. with you. I've a huge amount of time for Bennett Batters, mm-hmm. not agreeing with every single policy position.
Yeah.
But I think the way she's playing the American trade deal stuff is absolutely bob on, mm-hmm. and I think she's a really outstanding leader for the industry. But I'm not a member, which will irritate some members, and. I've always been slightly frustrated by us as an industry, our inability to tell our stories, our mm-hmm. inability to communicate with the general public, our inability to own the problems and to come up with the solutions.
Well, that's something that,
I think we have to get out in front of it. Mm. And it comes to the forefront with things like rewilding of the uplands. When you actually get to the bottom of that, what are people really saying? Yeah. That they'd like more nature, they don't want to pay for the wrong thing, they'd like to pay for the things that other things that they value as well as sustainable food production. Let's get out in front of it.
Mm.
Let's understand it better than anybody else. Let's start developing solutions all sorts of places. Let's show that we can put woodland back on commons. Let's show that we can do wood pasture effectively. Let's show that we can learn from places like NEP and we can use pigs in woodlands and graze cattle in really sensitive, thoughtful ways that are good for some of the wilder flowers and a lot of the flora and fauna. Let's think about how to think about our farms and valleys and wider catchments as ecosystems. And not just do that for doing its sake, but doing it so we're out in front and we win back, this is what I think, win back the trust of the public, win back the trust of the politicians of all varieties, actually genuinely begin to solve some of the significant problems that do exist in the British landscape. And I think if we can get to that point, it's not unreasonable to then push it back to the public and the politicians and say, okay, you can have it. You can have the England or UK that you dream of, you can have the wildlife you dream of, and you can have the really good food that you need, but you can't have it for cheap.
No,
you can't have it while you're screwing us in supermarkets, and you can't have it without paying some kind of payments around that. I'm gabbling that a little bit, but there has to be a moment where we are talking to them and we say we can look after this land properly that gives us the mix of things we need, complicated mix of things we need, but you've got to look after us.
Yeah.
And things like the American trade deal, the lowering of standards, which I think will inevitably come with that, are the exact opposite of that.
Mm.
And should be, I think we should all be fighting tooth and nail, and fighting tooth and nail with environmentalists.
Mm.
I think it's in all of our interest to have a more progressive compromise. A sort of compromise? I'm not even sure I like the word compromise, because what I think we can deliver in the uplands and in the rest of England's farmland isn't a sort of compromise. I think it could be amazing.
I think
it could be really amazing. I think in the uplands, we can deliver something really amazing. And I think we're starting on that journey at the moment. I can see enough to give me a lot of hope.
Yeah,
I'm not despairing at all about the uplands. Commons are particularly tricky. They're not all a disaster. Some are quite good, well-managed, others less so. They're particularly tricky. But when you see what's happening on the individual farms here and elsewhere, and there's this sort of real takeoff of regenerative agriculture ideas about soil, about grazing management, about putting the habitats back, about managing rivers and wetlands better, I don't think we need to be scared of it. I think we should stop being scared of it. Stop being defensive. Get out in front, own it.
Mm. And I think sometimes it's just talking to the politicians and the sort of policymakers, and it's not their fault. A lot of them aren't from farming backgrounds. They have very broad portfolios. Sometimes it's just getting them out on the farm and saying, look, we want to get there too. These are the sticking points.
Yeah.
Let's work together to overcome them, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I can't do the ecological stuff I'm doing on this farm without understanding some quite complicated ecological stuff.
Yeah.
I've either got to get that from a book or a podcast or a YouTube film, or I need somebody to help me.
Mm.
Just come and tell me what is it you're actually talking about? What do you want? And quite often it isn't a cost to farming. Quite a lot of what we're doing is in the edges. Or things like field trees. Having more willow, alder, whatever it might be, in fields is a good idea. Most farmers are hearing that as, how the hell would I put trees in my field? Like, this is a dumb idea. But actually, in our field, they're quite happy to put tree cages in the wet areas, in the rush areas that grow no grass whatsoever, that I'm probably losing money on trying to sort of fight the rushes. Mm-hmm. There's really unproductive, useless places on my farm, largely useless, where I can do the thing that they want.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're prepared to come up with the money to do it, what are we arguing about?
Yeah.
There are things which are difficult. Like, I think your farms may be more difficult than mine, with it being sort of more intensive, more flat. less wasteful edges, mm-hmm. sort of wasted edges. Okay, that's a different challenge, mm-hmm. isn't it? And I know you'll rise to that in your own way, and it's not for me to tell you how, but I think it's an exciting time to be a farmer.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't want to dwell on the former Rock and Roll Farming guest, George Monbiot, but when I spoke to him, he was very adamant about the fact that lots of upland areas need to be rewilded. And I think he speaks in very broad terms about that. When he wrote that article, I think it was Sheep Wrecked a few years ago now, would you... Well, first of all, how do you feel when people write things like that? But also, would you react differently now to how you perhaps would have when that article first came out 5-6 years ago?
Okay, so I should try and be as truthful as possible. So I found that quite an interesting challenge.
Yeah.
I think George is quite an interesting challenge. He's absolutely fearless. He does his own thing. He's not everybody's cup of tea, or necessarily my cup of tea.
Yeah.
But... if there's an unpalatable piece of truth to be spat out about the environment that we all need to hear, he's your man quite often. Yeah. So that's he and others. I think it was changing before that article. There was already a growing awareness from the sort of mid 1990s onwards. Schemes are changing, attitudes are changing.
Yeah.
I think he would like to make more of his role in the churches than I would perhaps historically give him. But anyway, that came out and it was an interesting challenge and it got a lot of attention. What is he actually saying? I shouldn't be speaking for him because he can speak for himself very ably. I think basically what a lot of the rewilding talk is, why are we spending our public money on the wrong things, which are seemingly against nature? Why are we not getting enough nature and the other things that we need, that we now want? What the hell are you lunatics doing? Let's pull the plug on you. Let's let it all collapse and let's just have nature. At that level, that's all right. We do need more nature in the uplands. It is changed by what it's been. It is impoverished in lots of places. We do need to hear that. We need to think about it and need to respond to it. Some of my sheep farming friends won't want to listen to that. Most are adapting to it. Most have been in environmental schemes at least since the 1990s and restricting stocking rates. Two of my sheep farming neighbours have just spent £26,000 on a peat bog restoration. Okay, they got their money back 8 or 9 months later from the RPA, but for 6 or 8 months they've funded money they can't afford to do a peat bog restoration, even though they're sheep farmers. All of the environmental enhancements in the Lake District, or many of them, are being funded, at least in the or bankrolled until they're paid back by sheep farmers. They were actually the banker. And what am I actually saying? I'm rambling a little bit. I'm quite prepared to take it on the chin that there's not enough nature in the uplands. Then the question becomes, well, what should there be and how do you get it back? And I think when you get into the nitty-gritty, it's not so relevant. The challenge is interesting, but when you actually start to talk about, okay, what would that look like? How would you do that in places that belong to people or that are commons? How would you mix up those habitats? How would you manage it? Then he's not that relevant. Yeah. There's nothing in his book or his articles which helps you with that. You're then into a different conversation about what do we mean by rewilding? Do we mean abandonment? Most of the ecologists I know don't think abandonment's a good thing because there's nothing like a wild ecosystem. There were actually large herbivores. There was disturbance of wild boars. Mm-hmm. There's all sorts of stuff going on in our upland ecosystems in the past that's no longer going on. Does he mean just more trees? That might require tree planting and tree guards, even though he doesn't like that. Or it might require killing an enormous amount of deer, which is management. Does it mean extensive cattle grazing? So a lot of the rewilders now actually believe in extensive cattle grazing, which allows sort of patchy succession to happen, ecological succession. When you get to the nitty-gritty, George doesn't have a lot. George doesn't have a lot to say. He's not somebody who you'd go to work out how to do it. We have a rewilded fell behind us. We have other places where we're doing all sorts of stuff. What I would say is it requires, in the absence of the large herbivores and the large carnivores, what is it really? It's a bit like NEP. It's a highly managed, sort of human-shaped system. It's just humans trying to do stuff that's more nature-friendly, really, trying to mimic natural processes and natural ways, putting cattle in or horses in or pigs in at the right time, taking them out. What does it really mean to rewild the uplands? Does it mean that we would put a fence around them? And like a sort of safari park, and we put the large herbivores in. Do they go in the roads, like there's main roads and things, or do we fence it into multiple little parcels? what the hell is this? When it actually comes down to it, it doesn't really mean anything. It's little more than a cry of anguish that we need more nature and we're a bit pissed off with the uplands. That's about it, really.
Yeah.
What I find much more useful is some of the second generation of rewilding books, Isabella Trees, yeah. Benedict MacDonald. They're much more interesting because they're telling me practically what do I do on a piece of land to... It turns out thorny scrub and willowy scrub are amazing habitats we don't have. All right, how do I create those in my riparian strips? How do I graze them to mimic NEP? I can do that.
Mm-hmm.
I find the word rewilding slightly comical. It doesn't even mean anything. Like, what is the program that we're talking about? At the big superficial level, we need more nature, great, and we need more natural processes. If it means that, I'm a rewilder. I'm doing more than most of them.
Yes.
It doesn't mean anything more specific than that. No. That's the problem. It quickly comes unstuck. It's just a sort of label. It's a I want more nature thing. When we get into the practicalities, it's a whole different ballgame, and a lot of it needs people.
Mm.
People with skills, people with the ability to know how to graze livestock or of any kind in a certain way. And... yeah, it's also slightly deranged about sheep, isn't it? Let's be honest. So you can actually do amazing regenerative grazing with mobbed up flocks of sheep with a long period of recovery between them. It's something we've been working on for the last 2 years. I've yet to show an ecologist the butterflies, the insects, the bees, the herons, the kestrel, whatever else that's living on the voles and frogs and things that doesn't like our grazing model. It's getting towards something very like nature, highly managed. But it's managing in a way that's nature mimicking. Do my views reflect all hill farmers? I suspect if George was here, he'd say, "Who the hell is this guy with his weird progressive views for a farmer? He's nothing to do with most hill farmers." There's some truth in that. A lot of the uplands isn't being shaped by this kind of thinking, but an increasing amount is.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It makes total sense. Yeah. I mean, I enjoyed speaking to George, but yes, I don't obviously agree with a lot of.
I mean, he's not. No. He's not an expert on farming in the uplands. No. Nowhere near. No. He's not an expert on the ecology of the uplands.
No.
And he's got no viable plan to actually do anything.
No.
What he is, and I think he described himself as this in the past, was a professional troublemaker. Used to be his tagline on Twitter.
Very much
it's
so,
quite good fun and quite necessary sometimes. You wouldn't go to a professional troublemaker for a sort of clearly thought through solution.
No.
And sometimes it makes it worse.
Yeah.
It
does.
There's a lot of times where we can't have a sensible conversation in the uplands because we're too triggered.
Yeah. A lot of farmers have just stopped listening.
Stopped listening because they think it's silly. Yeah. Like, who are these people? Like, insane. And I have to say, I lost a bit of respect for George when he was challenged about how much of the uplands he wanted to be wild. Mm. And he said 10% to the event in London. And at that point, I thought, I now no longer know what this is all about. I at least could respect when you wanted the whole lot, even if that didn't totally make sense. But what does he mean 10%? Like a 10% lump? A 10% of each valley or each national park? Or 10% of every farm? We're probably doing that already. Mm. And I'm also troubled by rewilding because it's too much. It gives up on too much farming. It says that's screwed. Let's just grab the remnants in the mountains or wherever we can, or in the Scottish Highlands. And I think it's defeatist and slightly disappointing and apathetic because I think we need to change the whole landscape.
There's so much more we can do
than that. It embraces the worst kind of farming, the farming that we need to get away from because it's totally unsustainable.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he would argue we're going to go to synthetic foods and all that sort of stuff, but you know. Good luck with that.
Before we get into that, you've kind of hinted at this, but you're often mentioned by high profile politicians, and I've sort of seen Michael Gove speak a few times when he was DEFRA minister, sort of almost held you up as a farming example to other farmers.
God, that's creepy, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it is. How do you feel about that?
I don't go anywhere near it.
No, I suspect.
I don't go anywhere near it. No. I don't take any of it particularly seriously. No. Am I a better farmer than my neighbours? I would never claim.
I know you wouldn't.
I would never claim that. We're doing some stuff that might be quite interesting. That's part of a sort of general wave of farming changing. Do I think I'm some sort of guru or whiz? No, really uncomfortable with that. There are people who have devoted their lives to regenerative agriculture practices for the last 20, 30, 40, 50 years. They're the sort of quiet heroes that kept this thing coming. And I'm just learning from them, trying to work out practically how you do that on a fell farm. We're doing some mixes of things that's maybe near the cutting edge in the uplands. But I don't have a lot to do with politics. I never really want to have a lot to do with politics. I as I think I tried to say earlier, I'm not even part of farming politics. I've never in my whole life been to a farming conference in Britain. I don't speak at them. I don't vote at them. I, you know, whatever happens at them, I'm not part of that. I just decided a long time ago I would try and be as true to what I believe as I can on my own farm, and I would try and write about it in a way that felt true to me in my books. If that doesn't do anything at all outside of my house, so be it. And if it influences people because I wrote a good book and they want to be influenced by it and they think it makes sense, great.
Yeah.
But I'm not hung up on that. In fact, it's very nice if people like your books and think you're important in some way, but I don't think that's a particularly healthy thing for people either. I think the less fame and celebration people have, maybe the better it is.
Okay. Let's get on.
That's probably a Lake District thing. We don't like big heads or stand up.
Northern thing. Let's go on to the second book, English Pastoral. How difficult was it following up to that first book? Is it like this sort of the difficult second album syndrome?
Yeah, it's difficult to write a second. When I was writing the first book, I said to my agent, my London agent, I said, do I put everything in this book? Or should I hold some back for a future one? And he said, you probably only get one go, so I would put everything in it. And then I did. And then when you come to write the second one, you think, you bastard. I could have held a bit of this back.
Yeah.
I found it really difficult. When my dad died 5 years ago was when I started writing the book. And I was I think the only thing emotionally in my head
You started writing it as soon after the first one as that?
Yeah. So I've been on a while. Probably wasted about 2 years because I wasn't quite ready to do it. And really sort of emotionally in my head, what's going on at that time, I'm just processing my dad's gone. I'm in a kind of weird place because I've just had a sort of weird best-selling book. So I've been pulled all over the place. It's not a good time to sort of be fresh and focused. Yeah. So I had a bit of time wasting. I wrote some nice scenes and stuff, but I couldn't quite get into total focus to do it. And all I could write about really at that time was, there were a lot of them were like memories of my dad. I think I'm like a lot of writers. I sort of think you can cheat death. You can cheat mortality by writing it somehow. That my dad won't be dead if I write. I've never said it quite like that, but that's probably the truth, isn't it? I think if I can write my dad really beautifully and clearly, he's not dead.
Yeah.
He's never dead. You can save him for the ages. Yeah. You know, that kind of ego. So that was difficult. It took me, I described the process earlier, but it took me a while to muddle through, to work out what it was I was trying to say. And I realised after a while, really, that although I was telling very personal stories about my family, I really wanted to talk about this sort of journey of trying to understand what farming is and what we were and how we sit in, how we sort of sit in a whole flow of how farming changed. Sort of. So there's three parts of the book. The first bit is called Nostalgia, and it's about the way my grandfather farmed. It's about a mixed rotational farm that do many of the things that they did in the past and had quite a lot of good about it in terms of soil management and biodiversity. And then there was a shift away from that in the middle section of the book's called Progress, about what were these things that came. And that took me a long time to think through, you know, what was it that changed? It was bigger and faster tractors. It was a sort of new armory of pesticides, herbicides, new synthetic fertilizers. When we look at really what changed in the last 50 or 100 years, there's a whole bunch of new tools given to farmers. Yeah. And it's less physical, manual. It becomes more mechanical. The horsepower applied to a field massively increased. And because it has all sorts of knock-on effects, doesn't it? You need a bigger field. You need less. You need it to be more efficient.
Yeah.
You need to think about it more industrially. And everybody's cheering us on. Everybody, not only cheering us on, they're paying for us, aren't they? They're paying us to drain the field. They're telling us that if you want to be modern, you have to think like an industrialist. You have to get big. You have to get smart. Get big or get out. As Earl Butts in America, there, Nixon's agriculture secretary. So we're really egged on. And we probably like it a bit as well, because we'd always wanted to conquer nature. We'd always wanted to have the perfect field of grain with no weeds. So there's something in us that likes this. The chemists come up with these things and give us them, and I'm like, Jesus, we can kill all the weeds, crack that on.
Well, like it or not, we enthusiastically pulled out hedges.
Yeah.
You know, all right, we were paid to do it, but from a farming point of view, people did say, it would be better if we had bigger fields.
And that's both positive beliefs, isn't it? We think it's progress.
Yeah.
We think it's making shit food cheaper. We think we're doing the job we're told to do. And there's some negatives in there as well, isn't it? We're not really aware of what good a hedge did anyway.
Yeah,
we're not sort of ecologically literate in the way that you might want us to be. And we don't have a sort of culture of, we think we're good stewards. We all think we're good stewards of our farms, but are we really?
Yeah.
I think we're weaker than that,
than
we'd like to be.
Yeah.
The new technology, the new idea, the new lower prices comes and we, either because we want to or because we bloody well have to survive. We do everything that's pushed at us. Mm-hmm. And where does that lead us? And we know where it leads us. And this might be the hardest bit of the book for farmers to read. Some will be very aware of it. Some don't want to know.
Mm-hmm.
That takes us to not a great place, doesn't it? Where we're now told that a lot of those things we did and were told to do are deeply problematic.
Yeah.
The field's too sterile. The hedge isn't there. There's not enough trees. The soil is compacted and doesn't have enough soil life in it. We've been grazing too short instead of long. There's less diversity in the field. The field everyone's been driving past for 50 years isn't the same field, actually. It's a completely different field. Mm-hmm. The microbiology, everything's different. And then the final part of my book's called Utopia, and it isn't about utopia because there isn't one, is there? It's about reality, mm-hmm. right now. So what do we do? What do you do on your tenanted farm? Mm-hmm. What do I do on my farm to make a living, pay the bills, try and survive, do something that's meaningful to us, and address all of those challenges? And I'm never going to tell all farmers what they should do better, because I don't know enough mm-hmm. to tell you what to do on your farm. I never will. But I have a fair idea what it looks like on our farm. Mm-hmm. And as you've seen this morning, we're trying to implement that.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I think it's right, really. If nobody ever pays any attention, I'm still going to do it. It's not about being considered wise or cutting edge or anything.
Yeah.
I just believe it's the right thing to do.
There's been part of the change in farming, I think, has been in many ways the change of pace. So my grandfather passed away last year. He was 97 and he was fully lucid right to then. I used to talk to him about farming when he was sort of my age and younger. And I asked him one day, I actually had him on the cab bailing with me, air-conditioned cab, nice yeah. tractor high up, and he was looking around. And I said, do you think farming's more fun now or when you were younger? And he said, absolutely when I was younger, because it was more of us, and it was, even though it was harder work and it was dusty and stuff and that. And okay, nostalgia can sometimes cloud these things. But sometimes I think with farming, we're so busy charging on, yeah. paying the bills that we don't even notice that hedge that's been neglected. Because you walk past it five times a day. You don't even see it.
I think the figures show that, I don't know what the figure is, it's something similar here, but in America, the typical agricultural worker is 12 times more productive.
Yeah.
In terms of getting through 12 times more work than they were in 1950.
Yeah.
You're speeding up is part of what my new book's about.
Yeah.
It's sped up. And whose job was it to stop it? Like,
yeah.
if it's wrong, we're now told it's wrong. Who should have stopped it?
Yeah.
Was it your granddad's job to not get a new tractor or yeah. faster mower? Did the environmentalists fail to be listened to about it was screwing things up? Is it the engineer at the John Deere factory? Is he responsible because he built a combine which doesn't drop any grain on the stubble? This is a very human mess because although some people might like it to be about good guys and bad guys, it's not really, is it? It's about ordinary people swept along.
Mm-hmm.
By a whole load of new technologies until you get to somewhere and somebody goes, whoa, you went the wrong way.
Yeah, and a whole load of society changes.
Yep.
Why does society change?
Supermarkets, cheap food, yeah. all of that. Yeah, all of those things. There's like a dozen things on that list that you'd have that conspire to make farming something else.
Yeah.
And that's quite daunting because you think, wow, can it really ever be anything else now? Have we built a trap? How would we get out of that? And I think rewilding is one of the ways that people have convinced themselves you can get out of that, but it doesn't convince me. It's not a sort of coherent, progressive answer to the series of problems. It just picks a bit off the edge and says, we'll have that, thanks. So what is the new book? The new book is about that.
Yeah.
What was the farming of your grandfather and mine? What was the farming of your father and mine? What the hell is it? What are those things that changed it? And I've tried to write about each of them.
Yeah.
The changing technology, the changing pace, the changing tools. Not in a highly technical, boring, long way, just in a very human way. Mm-hmm. Like, I can remember the first time that I used like thistle spray on our thistles. We used to, until I was about 30, we chopped thistles with an old bangy pasture topper.
Yeah.
But we did the outsides of the fields with a scythe and a sickle.
Yeah.
I actually spent my early teenage years with a scythe and a sickle. It's prehistoric now.
Yeah.
And I can remember like 2 years later getting a sprayer and getting the thistle spray and realizing you could completely defeat thistles.
Mm.
So it's those kind of stories that I've told in the book. I'm just like, I was the person that did it. Like, I cleared the thistles.
Yeah.
And I utterly believe that was the right thing to do. Do you know what's really bad? I like birds even then, and I wasn't making the connection between the two. And the morning after I did my first thistle spraying, I found a nest full of dead robin chicks. And I know I found them. And yet I shut that out of my head.
Yeah.
I knew that wasn't right.
Yeah.
I'm not saying there was a perfect solution to get rid of the thistles. I'm not sure saying that we wanted to carry on siding mm-hmm. forever. But you're into some tricky, murky territory, aren't you? You're like, hang on a minute, that's, I did it. I sort of knew it wasn't right. Mm-hmm. I sort of turned my head off to get away, to carry on. I did get rid of all the thistles. We don't now sign. Mm-hmm. It's about what being a human is, isn't it?
It is.
It's complicated.
Yeah. What kind of reaction do you think you'll get from farmers who read the book?
I don't know. I think maybe in the middle section of the book where I'm talking about how it becomes problematic, I have really good farming friends who don't think it's problematic. Not accepted it. Yeah,
okay.
They love their big tractor.
Yeah.
They love the speeding up of things. They've, in many cases, worked their ass off, borrowed a lot of money to be the survivor, to be mm-hmm. the place that's big. Do they want to think about that it might be problematic?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure they all do. They probably all don't read books. They might not bother to read my book if they realise what it's about. But I think a lot of farmers like you and me and many of the other farmers that we know are actually living this at the moment. They're grappling with it.
They're thinking about it, aren't they?
And all I've really tried to do is tell a very honest human story about my granddad's farming, my dad's farming, and mine, and say, this is what it was to us, and this is the mess we got in, and this is what I think us getting out of it looks like.
Mm.
And who knows, if it's successful, then people will talk too much about everybody doing my thing, just like they talk too much about NEP, or they talk too much about... People like focusing on a token thing, don't they?
They do.
And maybe they'll do that with mine after my book, who knows. That's not the point of the book, really. Mm. The point was to say just that here's the sort of broad sweep of how this got like this. It's all too complicated, all too human, and this is our own personal response, which you're seeing in the fields, actually.
Without a doubt. You've been writing it for, do you say, 5 years?
Don't keep going on about that.
It's... how does it feel when you finally hand it in, finished?
When you finally press send and you know you can never touch it again.
Yeah. Do you feel a bit bereft?
No, I just feel panic. I'm like, shit, there was half a dozen bits. I think maybe with another year and a half, I could have been slightly better.
Yeah, okay.
Was I clear enough about this? Or will I offend this person or that person with something a story I've told? All that goes through your mind. Then it goes very quiet and you think, I wonder if anyone will even read this. Will anyone care? And then there's quite a nice moment, which I've just gone through, which is they send it out to various writers and stuff for the blurb comments. And that helps to settle the fear a little, or has, in this case. So I had amazing feedback from Catelyn Moran, Philip Pullman, and Alan Bennett in the last 24 hours has said a really nice thing about it. And when I got the loveliest comment, I'm bragging now, but the loveliest comment the other day from Wendell Berry, he said that the scenes about my family were just about perfect and it belongs with the finest writing of its kind. And you think, 17-year-old me would have taken that. And one of my, like a novelist who's one of my writing, not so much hero, but I deeply admire his writing, is Hisham Mattar.
Okay.
Absolutely gorgeous writer. He wrote a book about his father being killed by Gaddafi or in a Gaddafi prison. And for me, one of the best writers on the planet, and he's written a really lovely thing on the front. It's gone on the front cover. So there's a nice bit in the middle, and then you start a new fear, which is, what happens if I upset everybody? What happens if I upset every farmer I've ever known and been friends with? What happens if people don't like what I've had to say? And this book is very close to the bone in terms of things that matter in farming, and people aren't going to agree with every word of it. That's okay.
But you wouldn't want people to.
No, I don't want that. I just want to say what I think's true and to hell with it. And about halfway through writing it, I have a friend called Caroline Grindrod who's really cool about a lot of regenerative farming stuff. And she said, would it pass the 100-year test? And I said, what's the 100-year test? She said, well, if you come back in 100 years, will you regret having said this? Or will you think it was the right thing to say? Have you got sort of long-term belief in it? And I have. Mm. I believe what I've said, absolutely. I don't have all the answers to everything, but I do believe in the sort of ethos of the book. And I do believe in the arc of the history and where we went wrong. I think in my family we're a little bit more sceptical about progress than many people are. So there'll be lots of very progressive farmers who've done very well and built things up, which might feel a bit criticised by some of the history in it.
Mm-hmm.
But I said what I believe is true.
You can't really.
You can't live your life one.
No, you can't. Have you started writing the next one already?
Yes.
In your head at least, or have you actually started getting words down?
I started 18 a year ago.
Okay.
Writing the next one, and it's nothing to do with farming.
Really? Okay.
Nothing to do with me, even.
That's interesting. Okay.
So I'm in the amazingly privileged position at the moment is I'm doing quite well. Penguin like what I do, yeah. and they want to back me to be a writer, mm-hmm. out and out writer. And I had another idea about a completely separate subject, which I'm not going to tell you about.
No, I wouldn't expect it.
But I was, I'm very lucky. I've got a really good deal with Penguin to write that. And I'm just so excited about it. It's going to be lovely to not write something that upsets my family friends, that isn't about me.
Yeah.
And there's... And actually, is I may not be when I get down to the nitty gritty, but that in some ways is easier. Actually, I don't have to do as much soul searching. I can just be a writer, and I can write about these people in this place that I happen to be really in love with and fascinated by this other thing. And
that's very exciting.
Yeah, and in the course of researching that, I've been spending a lot of time in another place with another group of people, and they've become like a second family to me, and a whole other cycle of craziness, which is making my life richer, is going on at the moment. So I'm my editor might kick me for saying this, but I'm done. I'm not going to write anything else about farming.
Yeah.
I'm not going to write anything else about me unless I live for a very long time. Very long time, I'll get very hard up. I'm not. I've got a whole bunch of ideas of other things and places I want to write about. Similar themes about different sort of, I like writing about sort of forgotten or ignored people and trying to give them voice and explain who they are. So that's kind of what I do. I'm come good, bad, whatever the reaction to this book is going to be. I won't be writing about farming again, and I won't be hanging around talking about it too much either. I feel like I've had a supremely privileged position to have been given people's attention for two books to talk about it. That's enough.
Yeah.
I don't want to be that old guy that never disappeared, that didn't know when it was time to shut up.
Yeah.
Judging by this podcast, which goes on forever.
We're nearly finished.
I could be that guy.
We are nearly finished. People listening, English Pastoral is available in all good bookshops, is it?
Yeah, from September the 3rd. It's published by, this is the professional bit.
Yeah, we've got to do this.
It's published by Alan Lane. And I hope people like it. And I hope it makes people think a little bit more about farming, like what is it, where's it coming from, what's driving it. And I sincerely believe that farming's not the peripheral thing it felt like when I was growing up in our culture. I feel like it's one of the most important things. It's about how we manage land, how we eat, how healthy we are, what it looks like out the window. And I just want to do my bit. It's probably the last bit I'm going to do, but I just want to do my bit to get people's focus on that, really. Stimulate them. And if they don't agree with me, that's fine too. I'm not interested in sort of world domination or to impose my views on everybody else. I've just had this very lucky moment where I got to write about everything I loved about and tell a story.
Okay. Let's wrap this up with the hard-hitting quick questions. And you've already done Desert Island Discs, which I wanted to ask you about. But I'm going to ask you, what is your all-time favourite song? Now, the song you said you'd say from The Waves on that interview was Kirsty MacColl and New England. Is that still your all-time favourite song? Because these things change, don't they?
They do change, but I don't...
I love that song, by the way.
I'm quite stubborn. I was going to change, but when you just said the name, I'm like, no, actually, I really love that song.
Yeah. I
put quite a lot of thought into thinking about that. It isn't that I think it's a perfect song or it's necessarily in the genre that I like most. There's just something about it that makes me think of home and growing up and that age that I've lived through. I can think of all sorts of sort of rockier tunes that I might have switched to, but no, I think I'll stick with that.
Okay. Outside of home, where's your favourite place you've ever visited? Now, you mentioned Malawi earlier, didn't you?
I have two. So Malawi's right up there.
Yeah.
I went to a place called Cape Maclear on Lake Victoria. Man, it's an amazing like village of people and like the way they lived and stuff. It blew my mind. I'm very, very in love with Africa. One of the last things I did before I sort of spent more time writing and less time working for UNESCO was I worked in five or six places in Africa briefly. I'm blown away by the beauty of it, the staggering beauty of it and how different it is. And I just love the people there, including in Sudan, actually. I spent an amazing period of time with some people in Sudan who I just love. Completely mad place with every kind of socioeconomic problem known to man, but the people I loved. So, I'm going to go for Malawi and I'm going to keep a secret where my other one is because it's what my next book's about. I'll come back on the podcast someday and talk about the other one.
When that book comes out, I'll come up again if it's all right and then I can see all the progress on
the
spot.
It's not very farmy, so maybe it won't qualify, but we'll see.
Well, I might be doing another podcast by then. You studied history in Oxford. What three historical characters would you most like, or people from history, would you most like to meet over a few beers?
I was agonising over this last night. Every time I picked three people, this is how nerdy I am, I kept thinking, they wouldn't actually have fun.
Would they get on?
They wouldn't get on. I was like, worried about all these sort of social dynamics.
I would think about
my daughter, that. Yeah. My daughter said, Dad, stop being pathetic. That question isn't designed for this kind of introspection. So who would I pick? Oh, I'm sort of grasping at straws. Right up there at the absolute top of the tree of my heroes, and it might sound a little bit pretentious, but it's meant genuinely, is Tolstoy.
Okay, yeah.
I think I'm having Tolstoy. He's a complete crackpot about loads of things. He's blathering on about veganism and mending shoes. And, but we'll get him out scything. So I might go out scything with a cask of beer. But Tolstoy, I'm going to have Albert Camus, the French writer, who I absolutely adore. I'm going to have Fernand Braudel, who's my favourite historian. Most people have not heard of Fernand Braudel, but he's this amazing historian that has a huge impact on the way I think and write from the sort of 50s, 60s and 70s. And he basically looked at how landscapes worked.
Okay.
And I think he said something at one point, like, if every king and queen and great man and woman had never existed, what would history be like? And he said it would be broadly the same, because the way that you grow grapes, the way that you grow grain, the underlying structures that make everyday life possible would still be exactly the same. You can change the kings and queens, but the real life would be largely the same. So he was interested in those systems, and I love that thinking.
Yeah.
And then who's my final choice? I've forgotten her name. The African American lady who had chosen Desert Discs, a Desert Island Discs, who sang Mississippi Goddamn.
Oh, Nina Simone.
Nina Simone. I'm having Nina Simone. She's mad as a bag of cats. She's probably going to throw a hissy fit in the middle of this night, but she'll give the rest of us boring guys that like books something to talk about.
Is an excellent choice.
And she'll probably just call us all worse than shit or whatever. There's something about her. Look, there's like a fire in that woman that I absolutely love.
Absolutely. If you decided that with the vast profits you gain from English pastoral, you were going to buy a big boat to sail around Ulswater, what would you call it?
This is total rubbish. The idea that I'm going to buy a boat, no way. The idea I'm going to make a fortune writing books.
Well, so the other questions are so serious.
No one's going to make a fortune from writing a book. It'd be quite, if I happen to make any money out of the book, I'm going to be trying to buy the last bit of farm for the members of my family, which would help them out and help to secure it for the future.
Yeah.
I still have a mortgage on my house, so I'm lucky. I made a bit of money out of books, but I'm by no means wealthy. I would never, ever buy a book. I hate leisure. My whole life is devoted to the three things I love, which...
You live in the Lake District.
I don't want a bloody boat. I've got a kayak that we bought secondhand off a farming friend, which occasionally we go on the lake with, but I'm not a leisure person. I don't like chilling out.
No.
There's like better things to do. I feel like the stopwatch is clicking. I'm genuinely one of those people that thinks you could be dead in like 2 years' time and you want to write two books before then. Like, get a move on. Like, what the hell are you doing playing on a yacht? Like, go home, work. That might make me sound like Jack's a very dull, boy.
No,
that's who I am. I'm on fire like that. I'm like, come on, bring the next thing on. Let me do it. Because I think I'm on the way out.
Yeah.
The clock's ticking. We haven't got very long.
Burning daylight. Yeah. In daylight, as a friend of mine says. Yeah, okay, you've missed the chance to call it Helen there and get any good books, but that was an open goal for you if we've missed. Okay, I always ask this question, always finish with this one. Many people answer with you, but what is your favourite agricultural-related social media account to follow?
If Helen was here, she'd say, I'm not a very good follower. I treat social media like a diary.
Yeah.
I'm sort of looking at what people are saying to my stuff, but I'm not a huge user of social media.
No, I've noticed.
Hugely sort of egotistical. I'm completely missing all this other amazing stuff.
Or who do you think does a good job then?
I tell you what I really like. There's something really sweet and decent and honest about it. Is Martha Roberts with the pigs.
Yeah.
I think, I don't know her. She's never met her. And I just think, I like you.
Yeah.
I like how you are with your pigs. And I'm sad that there isn't more farms like that. You might think I'm sentimental and nostalgic, but I think I'm sad there aren't more farmers like that. Mm-hmm. That there can't be more farmers like that. And it's honest and it's just decent and straightforward. For all I know, she could be a bank robber in a spare time. I don't know the lady very well, but she'd be very high up there. I also, partly because they live in a similar landscape and I know them quite well, I enjoy Neil Heseltine's account. That's actually a lie. I'm just saying that because he said me and his. No, I like Neil and Lee. I think they do a lot of good stuff. There's a lot of really, really good ones. In fact, there's so many good ones now. I don't, the imperative for doing it, which I had in 2012, doesn't feel like it's there anymore. I could never put another tweet out, and there's enough brilliant, smart farmers talking to the public, talking to other politicians. I'm not sure I'm adding a lot of value anymore.
Yeah, well, I actually, funny you say that, because I'm starting to think a little bit like that with the podcast, because I started it thinking, why isn't anyone doing this? And now there's so many good ones. I think, well, you know, how much longer will I keep doing it? I don't know.
And if you carried the ball a little bit, and, and other people are now running forward with it, fine. We don't need to, it doesn't need to be all about me, does it?
No. James, I've kept you for long enough. Thank you so much for taking the time. Can't wait to read English Pastoral. I keep saying English Pastoral. Is it English Pastoral or English Pastoral?
I've only been writing it. I haven't been going around saying it. How do you pronounce it? I would call it English Pastoral.
English Pastoral. I can't wait to read it, genuinely. Thank you. You know, I loved the first book. So, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Pleasure.
Yeah, great to have you finally on Rock and Roll Farming.
Thanks a lot.